99? Would you believe here comes Private? Then would you believe here comes the Sergeant? Would you believe here comes the Colonel?
Yes, 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 yes. I know, that's hard to believe. Well, welcome back. The second half hour, the promise of tomorrow, here on the Science News Radio Network, exploring the business of emerging science, nanotechnology, open innovation. I'm your host. I'm Colonel Mason. We're going to get right back to our very interesting guest, Dr. Adrien Bajan. He's the professor of the Pratt School of Engineering at Duke University and has some very interesting things to say about American education. Unlike a lot of people that come on this program, he believes that we're the model of the world. And of course, at the end of the program, listener comments and the voice of reason. And right now, though, we want to step over to our fountain of useless information we have here on the set to answer today's
question. The fountain of youth. Useless information. How can I help you?
Okay, we're looking for the name of an Australian mammal once thought to be a hoax. Americans first saw it at the Bronx Park in 1922. What is it?
I have given you my answer. And now you may tell me.
A duck-billed platypus, of course. A platypus. And now back to Dr. Adrien Bajan of Duke University.
The second way of discovering that the wheel with two spokes actually is everywhere is called animal locomotion. Is to recognize that animal movement and as just to be specific, discuss terrestrial. In other words, walking animals and running animals. Animal movement is a falling forward cycle. The animal body leans forward, starts falling, and then the fall, meaning the hitting of the ground, is prevented by the next leg, which catches the fall and lifts the body back up to the normal elevation. And so falling forward and then righting oneself up is in fact rolling. Rolling as a wheel consisting of only two spokes. A wheel that would have actually many spokes except that all the other ones except two are missing. You can imagine that each leg making a step, leg number one is spoke number one. And step number one, leg number two makes step number two, and then step number three, instead of being made by leg number three, which would come from over the head to appear in front of you, step number three is made by leg number one, which swings from behind and plays the role of leg number three.
So a wheel in rolling motion is a whole new way of looking at the way humans move about and run and act and that sort of thing, and we actually are emulating a wheel, is what you're saying.
Correct. Everything, that's right. Every animal body is both wheel and vehicle, all in one. There's no difference thermodynamically between a rolling let's say ball, which of course requires pushing or effort from an external entity that does the pushing. There's no difference between that and the rolling. The walking animal, which as I said earlier, is a rolling wheel of animal mass. This is just the beginning of an interesting series of ahas. One being the discovery of why bones exist, meaning why does the skeleton exist? In other words, legs are the main structure of the skeleton, and they come from this need to have spokes. And spokes are a design in mechanical engineering, a design that which is a column, one spoke is a column in compression, but this column is very famous in engineering as the strongest machine organ, the strongest for its weight, or if you fix the strength. It is the lightest organ for that required strength. So bones, just like the column and compression, are very, very clever designs. They're noble. They're very special. They're the way in which the book of mechanics begins, you see. Not only in our education today, but in the history of mechanics. You look at these columns in the Greek temples. They appeared, and they continue to appear today. For example, the columns at the entrance to MIT, because they are very, very, very good designs. If it is good, it sticks around. It works. The idea spreads, just like the highly perfected animal design that keeps on moving both as wheel and vehicle at the same time.
So then evolution would be a natural adaptation of these improvements in animals and humans and in nature. And then please explain to me then how all this applies to the things that you've been working on, automobiles. Are you trying to make cars more efficient, I mean, mechanically?
I used the automobile as a metaphor or something like that earlier. I do not work on automobiles. I work on the improvement, that is, in conceptual terms, of the engines, of the power plants, of the motors, of anything. And these improvements in the engines of the vehicles or in the power plants that are stationary on land are happening in one direction, in the direction of producing more work or power, if you will, per unit time. Okay, more work per unit of fuel burned. This work is not stored anywhere. There is no power, for that matter. Is not stored in a power bank. The produced work is destroyed immediately while moving things. So all the fuel that you burn becomes power, and the power is consumed or destroyed in order to move things, vehicles, to move whatever, including all the appliances in the kitchen, to move information through cables and waves and all these other things. So fire burns, and the result is that things move, improving the efficiency of the production of power is the phenomenon in technology evolution, because the natural tendency in nature is for things to evolve in the direction of moving more easily, which means moving more, moving farther, moving faster. So I just made a connection between the constructor law, which governs nature in the total, and technology evolution, which is the story of more efficient everything, more efficient power plants, more efficient vehicles, more efficient including more efficient language, more efficient writing, more efficient communicating, more efficient education, more efficient travel and human air mass transit. All these things are in accord with the direction in time that is commanded by the constructor law.
Now, Dr. Bajan, you're published in the American Journal of Physics, but you've written some books, too. Can you tell us a little bit about them?
Yes, I've been fortunate to have the opportunity. I've written 24 books, actually, and the more recent are about the constructor law. The constructor law made his debut in 1997 in my thermodynamics treatise called Advanced Engineering Thermodynamics, which is a Wiley book. After that, I wrote a book called Shape and Structure, From Engineering to Nature. From Engineering to Nature is the story of the constructor law in my mind, and then in the work of the group that has emerged. We've written two Springer Verlag books right after that. One is called Porous and Complex Flow Structures in 2004. This group that has emerged around the principle. Then in 2007, another Springer Verlag book called Constructal Theory of Social Dynamics. Here is where the electric spark falls into the over the fence into sociology, and we're having even today a lot of great time discussing this idea with the colleagues in sociology, meaning extending this idea from the rivers and the animals to the organization of society. We have made discoveries astonishing even to us in academia. For example, the fact that the rankings of anything, including universities or the rankings of the famous people, should not change. In other words, the rankings are rigid, no matter what people say.
Explain that to me. What do you mean by that? The rankings shouldn't change. The rankings are rigid. What is that? What do you mean?
The rankings is it means this, that every year we hear that in U.S. News and World Report that the top university in the United States is, for example, Harvard, and then Duke is I forget number 7 or something like that. And every university administrator then looks for donors, promising that with more expenditure, the ranking of University X will be improved dramatically. And what people are not paying attention to is the fact that there is no evidence that suggests that this kind of improvement really works. And the reason is the fact that education is a global flow system, just like the flow of water on the surface of the earth through channels, small and large. By the way, the large channels are big, the small ones are the large channels are a few, the small ones are many. And so education flows the same way. And it flows, for example, like the air route, you know, mostly between Western Europe and the Eastern United States. So the education flows in a historically generated and ossified system of river channels. And having to do with the oldest universities first, the way in which the globe was in fact covered with civilization and culture, and in this tapestry of famous and not so famous universities, the ones that were famous early have a historic place to occupy. And in other words, an MIT produces professors. In other words, the disciples of the professors at MIT then go elsewhere. They become professors, for example, at Duke, as I did. In other words, MIT's being number one is good for Duke. The disciples that I generated Duke go all over the globe. Therefore, Duke's being number 7 is good for everybody else. Not only downstream from Duke, but upstream of Duke as well, because it gives MIT even more reason to persist at being number 1 in engineering. In other words, it's a very stable, hierarchical flow structure that is connected in both directions on the vertical, upward and downward. By the way, the education flows in both directions. MIT learns plenty from all over the globe. The globe earns plenty from MIT and Duke and other upper nodes. And so the whole globe flows with science, and one administrator in one node, say one button on the quilt, is not going to shake the bed cover at all. Okay.
Well, that's a fascinating way of looking at things. But you explain to me this then. We've got a lot of complaints on this radio program that American educational system is failing, and that our people are falling behind, and that we have a very poor educational system. Are you saying there's no way then to improve it, and certainly not throwing money at it won't improve it any? Is that right?
Well, no. I will address your very important question next. Let me clarify. The previous joke was about the fact that the flow system is so evolved, so old, so well flowing, that and obviously constantly improving, even though it is what it is, that one cannot expect a cataclysmic change next year. There would be cataclysmic change if, God forbid, the eastern United States sinks into the ocean and those top universities disappear. The top universities of the United States from that region are also the top universities of the world, all right? So, to come back to your question, no, I'm actually very optimistic. I do not see the American seen as bleakly as you painted it, and I say that for a very simple reason. The American society is free, that is relative to other societies, and open to change. By the way, freedom is good for design. Without freedom, design makes no sense. Without freedom, improvement makes no sense. So if in the educational system there is freedom to say enough of this, we're going to do it this other way, then things are getting better. The places in the American system where freedom is less of an option, for example, in elementary, middle, and high school education, where the setup is rigid, where you have teachers' unions and things like that, the progress toward improving the delivery of education is somewhat slower. At the other end, and this is the real reason why the American universities are the envy of the world, is the relative autonomy of every university, every department, every school, where new science and new methods of teaching are in fact up to every professor to develop and then defend, and this swim or sink attitude at the American university level is what has made, frankly, jewels out of universities such as Duke, and as I said, the envy of the world. So I think the road forward is in fact very, very clearly traced. If a school, no matter what level and no matter what country, wishes to become better, then that school should learn and try to emulate what goes on at Duke University or another university like Duke. What I'm telling you is not a joke. You look at the evolution, what they're doing today in Western Europe, and obviously in the newly liberated Eastern Europe, all the universities and ministries of education are implementing changes that are in fact influenced heavily by a study of the American university system. There's no doubt about the direction in which the globe is speedwalking in the education domain. So we're superimposed on this evolution of the education flow system. Are there other flows that are embedded with the flow of not just ideas but also students and the parents and monies that are paid? They are the flows of the society on which this education flow vasculature is printed, the extent to which, or the ways in which the society supports the education vasculature, in other words, the donors, the communities, the local governments, the state governments, the local businesses. So once again, the European colleagues, who are actually our competitors, are looking very carefully at the manner in which the American society has been helping education, particularly higher education, throughout the history of the American Republic. They are looking at the institution of philanthropy, which is much smaller in Europe, and all these things that have created the American universities. So that's basically why I'm optimistic, but also I'm giving you the the constructive law reason for why I think that the direction is very healthy in the United States.
Well, Dr. Adrian Bajan, professor of Pratt School of Engineering at Duke University, your most informative, delightful conversation, and certainly giving us a new way of looking at things. And I want to thank you enormously for being with us today.
And now we make time for the voice of reason. Listener comments, ideas, and suggestions.
There's an old English priest from about 250, 300 years ago, Father Bayes, B-A-Y-E-S, and what he did is he basically described a process of human thought. So we give it a fancy name. We call it Bayesian thinking, but in fact, it's nothing more than everybody does. All of us are driven by evidence, every single one of us. We look around, we see the world, and we form opinions about how the world works. As a result of that, we now have a prior opinion about, prior means it's what we had coming into it, about how things go. So we have an opinion about what might happen in the football game. We have an opinion about that it's going to be colder in the winter than the summer. And that's a pretty good opinion because it's been, you know, leavened by lots and lots of evidence. But we're not always right. So what we are as humans is, you know, we are a thinking species, and therefore new data comes along. And when new data comes along, it revises that opinion, assuming that we're open-minded. There are some people who no amount of evidence changes their opinion, and I'm sorry to say they tend not to be open-minded. So in science, you must absolutely change your mind when the data change. I'm Stephen Schneider, and I'm at Stanford University, where I study the Earth's climate, and what we might be doing to it and how we can try to keep it better.
So you decide, has this really been the voice of reason? Listener comments are welcome at 214-329-4949. And please tell us your name and where you're from.
You've been listening to The Promise of Tomorrow with Colonel Mason, the definitive program on emerging and nanotechnologies, now archived and streamed on the web at promiseoftomorrow.biz. Join us next week at the same time as we learn more about the promise of tomorrow.
I am waiting for you.